Graham E. Fuller is a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, a former senior political scientist at RAND, and a current adjunct professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's the author of the new book, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. Fuller comes to the MSU International Center at 3:30 tomorrow to discuss the topic, ISIS and the Challenge to Leadership in the Middle East. WKAR's Peter Wharf caught up with Graham Fuller by phone this week to discuss his new book and this week's talk.
I think that ISIS is the phenomenon at the moment that seems to be grabbing so much global attention, and for understandable reasons, with its very horrific PR, its techniques of shock and awe to draw the West into this. But I'm interested in looking at what the origins of an organization like ISIS are. Certainly, it traces back at the very least to the war in Iraq, and I like to mention that history did not begin with 9/11, so that, in other words, there are precedents to a great deal of this that serve to explain the now rising violence and radicalism of much of the Middle East.
You touch on this notion in your latest book, Turkey and the Arab Spring, and you say in one of the chapters, if nothing else, Arab Spring makes one thing clear. The fall of dictatorships opens something of a Pandora's box, deeply destabilizing. And you mentioned that in a 2011 interview on Talk of the Nation on NPR, in which you said radicals prosper under adverse conditions. These would be those conditions that you're speaking of.
Well, that's exactly right. I think the destruction of Iraq and Afghanistan, for that matter, in the course of now two U.S. wars, have certainly served to radicalize both of these countries. When you turn political and social and even economic systems upside down, of course, I think citizenry is badly shaken. Clarity comes more from the radical side than it does from the moderates. All the ground rules are removed, are destroyed. It's a free-for-all. And under these circumstances, exactly, radicals do thrive. I don't want to suggest that they're all just bad guys. I mean, many of these systems have been frozen in place, such as in Egypt, for 30 or more years. And at some point, the system has to break open, and at some point, people are going to have to start dealing on their own with a more open society. Certainly, Islamic organizations tend to prosper most under these circumstances. And to say Islamic organizations doesn't necessarily mean extremely radical jihadi organizations such as we see in ISIS. So I guess my longer-term concern here is that the regions have to, at some point, be allowed to find their own way through political reconciliation, through gradual learning, through mistakes. All other countries have had to do that and are still doing it in many ways. So simply to impose, as the United States has chosen to do, and the British before them, to impose a leader that'll keep the lid on and look out for the interests of the West is not a formula for success. Indeed, I think this present catastrophic developments in the area are a kind of culmination of decades of those policies.
Graham E. Fuller is a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, former senior political scientist at RAND, and current adjunct professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He'll be on campus at Michigan State University this Friday at 3:30 at the International Center to speak on the topic ISIS and the Challenge to Leadership in the Middle East. We're talking about that upcoming engagement at Michigan State University and Mr. Fuller's recent book, Turkey and the Arab Spring. Also from your recent book, you talk about the challenge of the Arab Spring, so named in one chapter. And you've said that Ankara moved too far, too fast, too confidently, and was caught in what became a lose-lose situation for almost every single player in the region regarding Syria, and that Ankara will eventually emerge as the most powerful player in the future of Syria. Do you still believe this to be so?
Yes, I very much do so. I mean, let's face it, nearly everyone in the world misjudged the situation in Syria as rebellions began to rise against the Assad regime. But after all, we had seen the Tunisian dictatorship fall, rapidly followed by the fall of Mubarak in Egypt, and then rapidly thereafter Gaddafi in Libya, and then a longstanding Yemeni regime overthrown. So when within a month or two uprisings began within Syria, I think it was entirely logical for observers to assume that Assad's turn was probably next. And I would have said the same, or perhaps did even say the same initially, that it looked like this was part of a broader wave sweeping the region. In the event, it turned out not to be quite that way. And Assad has not been a highly desirable regime, but until the civil war broke out in the struggle against the Assad regime, it had not been all that brutal or disastrous. As a result, I think many people within Syria who may not like Assad fear that what could come after him could be far worse. And furthermore, they just look over their border to see the utter destruction that has taken place in Iraq as a result of the U.S. intervention there, and they certainly don't want to go there. Many minorities, Christian, Jewish, Druze, and other groups feel that a radical, especially the increasingly radical Islamic and jihadi character of the armed opposition against Assad is something that scares them. They don't want to go there, quite understandably. So I think this civil war, this war against Assad, the effort to overthrow Assad, is not working domestically on the part of the Syrians, and the external opposition is either feckless, as supported by the West, or incredibly brutal, as we see in ISIS. So in other words, we're stuck, and Turkey had made that same mistake, that they thought that, sure, now we're going to back democracy in Syria as well. I think it was a fine principle, but when it didn't work, it was time to cut their losses and pull back, and they have not done so. They've just continued to throw good money after bad.
Yeah. I had the opportunity 3 years ago through the Niagara Foundation in Chicago to travel to Turkey. And so I became very interested in the chapter that you've written in your book, Turkey and the Arab Spring, about popular Islam and the Gulen movement. Fethullah Gulen is a Turk imam living in exile now in Pennsylvania. I would say probably our average listener here in Michigan might not be familiar with with Gulen. Can you help our listeners to understand who he is and what is his influence, and to what does the Gulen movement aspire?
Sure. Fethullah Gulen is the founder and leader of a movement that is called Hizmet, or which means in Turkish service. It is a, I would consider, an extremely moderate Islamic organization. It does believe that religion and faith need to be promoted, but it believes that faith is not simply limited to Islam, that they believe in dialogue with Western religions, particularly Judaism and Christianity, although not exclusively there. They focus on, instead of looking for things to condemn or judge as being haram or unacceptable, forbidden in religion, he's saying, look, if you want to help the Muslim world, if you want to help the world in general, don't go out, if you're a wealthy person, don't go out and build just another mosque. We don't need more mosques. We need schools. The only way we're going to raise the level of the Muslim world and the world in general, but starting with the Muslim world, which is in trouble, is through education, and especially education in technical areas. So the membership in this movement has grown tremendously in Turkey over the last, 20 years, and particularly over the last decade. when it was permitted to play a larger role. So today, it's a very large, the largest civil organization in Turkey by far, probably the largest such movement in the entire Muslim world. Utterly condemns violence, has never been involved in any violent activity of any kind. It's now widespread with over 1,000 schools spread around the world that teach high-level courses, which are not aimed at religion, but at general education.
And there are those who accuse or place the Gulen movement as attached to a so-called parallel state in Turkey. What do you think about that?
Well, this is really an effort to discredit the movement on the part of the former prime minister and now president of Turkey, Erdogan. He and the Gulen movement had good relations and were shared common goals in the past of moving the military out of politics and in allowing greater religious freedom within Turkey rather than suppression of anything Islamic as earlier governments in Turkey had done. I should add that this has been the most prosperous and capable decade of government that Turkey has ever seen in its history, probably. So it's just simply because it has an Islamic tinge. The present government does not in itself signify any incompetence or fanaticism. But in any case, the two fell out, particularly over the fact of rising and more rampant corruption on the part of the ruling party, the AKP party, Justice and Progress Party. Gulen's movement blew the whistle on this because they don't see this as desirable government. As a result, Erdogan, formerly prime minister and now president, has struck back quite savagely at these revelations and some of the police, some of the members of Gulen who had been and who are in the police organization and doing some of uncovering some of this unsavory corruption activity. So unfortunately now there is a violent, non-violent, but harsh, sharp split between the Islamic government of Turkey and the Gulen movement itself, which basically wants to stay out of politics.
In discussing leadership and ethnicity, you say that Arab publics show far greater admiration for Turkey today than regimes do. Can you further explain that?
Sure. Most of the regimes of the Arab world, especially regimes which have been dictatorships, essentially autocracies, and that's been virtually every one of them, do not look with favor upon democratic countries' democratic process. I mean, they see this idea as threatening to their autocracy. So when Turkey has functioned as a very successful democracy for many decades, but becoming even more democratic in the last decade with removing the military from a role in governance, countries have looked to them with admiration. It isn't just either the Turkey's democratic policies, but it's the fact that it's number 16 now among developing economies in the world, quite remarkable. It has a dynamic economic sector. It has the most powerful army in the Middle East, except for Israel. It's a member of NATO. It aspires to be a member of the EU. It has, as I mentioned, as a country, Hizmet, which is the most moderate and successful civil Islamic movement in the world. And on top of that, it's had the self-confidence to be, it's also, by the way, accepted and acknowledged its Islamic past, which had warmed the heart of the Arab world, which saw Turkey as having turned its back and rejected them in earlier periods and thrown them into the control of British and French colonialism. And on top of that, which really impressed them with all those qualifications, it Turkey also began to have a more independent foreign policy, parted company with the U.S. on so many of the policies of starting with the Bush administration that it saw as disastrous. I would have to agree, I think many other observers of American foreign policy would agree, that these policies, the global war on terror and the wars in Afghanistan and Iran and elsewhere, have not led to anything, any improvements, and indeed has exacerbated conditions in the region. So when Turkey said no to Washington in 2003, saying, no, you may not invade Iraq through Turkish territory, the Middle East population sat up and took notice. But here's a country that's strong, aspires to be part of the West, but also is not bound to the West or simply a tool of the West, as so many of the pro-American dictators were in the region. That's, I think, the grounds for popular support for Turkey, even while authoritarian regimes across the area were made very nervous by this kind of a Turkey.
What was it that drew you to this place in the world that sparked your interest, that created a lifelong relationship?
Actually, I've been interested in the Middle East, grabbed by the Middle East, I should say, going back to age 17 when I used to look at National Geographic magazines and see pictures of deserts and camels and Arabic writing. And I always wondered how could people ever read this wild-looking language, and boy, I'd love to be able to do that, to learn that. So when I got to university, I did start studying some of these languages and was captured by them. I was drafted during the Vietnam War. Drafted during the Vietnam War and stuck into intelligence, which was something I didn't have a clue about. But anyway, got dragged along out of that and eventually into CIA, where I continued with a 25-year career in and on the Middle East. But my interest in the area preceded my ever having heard of what intelligence is, and continued well after thereafter. I left CIA 27 years ago, but still engaged. How could you not be?
Graham E. Fuller is former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including his most recent, Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. He'll be here at Michigan State University on Friday at 3:30 at the International Center to speak about ISIS and the challenge to leadership in the Middle East. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
You're most welcome. Happy to. They're important and significant topics and not quickly understood.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.